The following is a lecture by Dr. John Stagg, a professor of history at the University of Virginia and director of the James Madison Papers Project, as well as author of Borderlines and Borderlands. He spoke at the James Madison Museum on Sunday, May 15th, on James Madison and the Spanish Borderlands. The lecture was part of the museum's 2011 lecture series.
When Gareth Wooters contacted me about this, we agreed that I'd talk about the Spanish Borderlands. So perhaps I'd better say a word about why I chose that topic. One reason was that I'd just finished this book. Sort of deciding on something you've just written about is sort of about it's taking the line of least resistance. And it's still reasonably fresh in my memory. But some of you might be wondering what the Spanish Borderlands refers to. It's a sort of state of art. The term that entered into American historical writing was about the 1920s, 90 years ago. And it's a term that describes those northern rim territories of the Spanish Empire that at various points between about 1795 and 1845 came part of the United States. In other words, an arc of territory that stretches from the Florida Peninsula in the east, in fact, right across to California in the west. So we talk about Florida, the southern Gulf Coast, the Gulf Coast areas of what are now the states of Alabama and Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, and then across from Texas through to the Pacific Coast of California. That's what the Spanish Borderlands is. And, of course, some of the period I've talked about also coincides with Madison's own lifetime, especially when he was president of the United States. Now, we didn't agree on a title. But just to be playful and mischievous, when I was talking about this subject a few years ago, I did come up with a title for a talk like this. And the title was James Madison really the founding father of the Central Intelligence Agency? That'll get your attention for a while, but you're probably wondering how on earth could I come up with a title like this? It seems totally off the wall. After all, the CIA dates from, I think, 1947. Madison had been dead 111 years by that time. We associate Madison with notions of constitutional government, limited government, strict construction of the Constitution, doing things properly by the letter and the spirit of the law. And probably, if you look at the history of the CIA since the 1940s, perhaps we couldn't say that in all cases about the Central Intelligence Agency, particularly at the height of the Cold War. There was a lot of talk about CIA abusing its powers and things like that. So it seems fairly incongruous that I should actually try and put these two subjects together. So I better explain why I thought I could do this. And there are some serious points here. And there are two reasons why I put these together, or two sets of reasons why I put these two subjects together. One dates back to the relatively recent past, and another one dates back much further, in fact, years before World War II, the first third of the 20th century. Now, the relatively recent past starts in the 1970s. Maybe I'm dating myself when I describe the 1970s as the relatively recent past. When I talk to my classes, which are full of students who were all born late 1980s, the 1970s might as well be the Middle Ages as far as they're concerned. But the text here that I take off from, and many of you will remember this, is the investigations of the so-called Church Committee. The committee headed by Senator Frank Church of Idaho, into the activities of the CIA in the 1970s. And one thing that he was looking at, that committee was looking at, was the history of the CIA and covert operations, as they've come to be known. And here we learned about the attempts to sort of assassinate Fidel Castro with exploding cigars, the overthrow of the Salvador Allende government in Chile in the 1970s, the infringement of domestic civil liberties with things like the notorious Quintal Program, that's the acronym, how you actually pronounce it, I don't know, but that's That was part of it. And the Church Committee issued a severe rebuke to the CIA for these and other misdeeds, and it reinforced these findings with the argument that many CIA activities after 1947 departed a very long way from the principles and spirit of constitutional and lawful government of the sort that we associate with the Founding Fathers, particularly James Madison. Now, the Church Committee issued a report. It's 6 volumes long, and probably what is not generally known is the 6th of those volumes, it's not a very big volume, but it's there, is in fact is a historical volume produced by the Congressional Research Service, which laid out the historical evidence on which the committee based its charge that CIA activities had departed in important ways from fundamental American principles. Now, needless to say, the verdicts of the Congressional Research Service and the Church Committee did not sit very well for the Central Intelligence Agency. And it wasn't very long after that that the CIA actually made a response to this. The CIA has its own historians, and there's quite a number of historians working on its staff. It also has a historical journal. And sometimes you can't get into the articles in the historical journal because they're classified. But starting in the 1980s, one of the historical curators of the Central Intelligence Agency, a man named Edward Sale, actually, began research and compiling evidence to show that many American presidents before 1947, and presidents of the founding era particularly, had engaged in covert operations of one sort or another, and nobody had given a second thought to either their morality or their constitutionality. Now, he published this in an article in the CIA Historical Journal in 1986, but he was not alone, or he did not act alone. Over the past 25 to 30 years, there has been a small but steady stream of monographs, articles, reports. Usually they emanate from some government departments, think tanks, political science departments in universities. They tend to come from political science departments in universities rather than history departments. That may or may not be that significant. And sometimes a lot of freelance writers, some of whom have had dealings with the CIA in their past, and they all documented Sale's argument with as much historical evidence as they could find. Now, for fairly obvious reasons, people who are engaged in this sort of historical research focus particularly on the activities of those founding fathers who later became presidents of the United States. And, of course, that includes Madison. But getting right with the founding fathers is pretty much a standard trope in American political debate. We were just talking before we started, somebody was asking me what I thought the Tea Party was making of this period of American history for their purposes, and I said I'd rather not go there today, but in some ways we're dealing with a variation on that. Getting right with the Founding Fathers is pretty much a rhetorical tactic in American political debate, so it's not surprising that the CIA would try and make the most of it where they can. So in this quest for the historical legitimacy of covert operations, these agency historians, I'm using that term a bit loosely, sort of a coordinated, organized, central sort of activity. That's a number of people sort of coming at the problem from all sorts of directions. These agency historians didn't have to do very much digging in the historical archives. Now, one reason why they didn't is that they were able to rely on the founding or the findings of a group of scholars writing in the first third of the 20th century. Roughly the years before World War II, before 1939. And these historians' interests lay in the breakup of the Spanish-American Empire in the early 19th century. We've got to remember here that after Christopher Columbus's voyage, Spain went on to develop a huge American empire, which lasted for about 3.5 centuries. And it all suddenly came apart, very suddenly, between 1808 and 1822. And Madison, remember, was President of the United States and Secretary of State while this was happening. And it's the writings of these historians that form the second part, or the second set of reasons that I referred to earlier, about how I could put these two incongruous subjects together. Now, these historians who are writing after the turn of the 20th century performed yeoman service for the historical profession. It was they who were the first American historians to go into the unexplored archives of the Spanish government and Latin American governments, and they provided sort of the first reasonably well-informed picture that we had about how the Spanish-American Empire broke up and how the United States established political and commercial relationships with what would become the newly independent republics of Latin America. To give you an example that some of you may be familiar with, it was these historians who first documented the activities of Brigadier General James Wilkinson, who was the ranking general in the United States Army in the early 19th century. And they got documentary evidence that James Wilkinson, although the ranking general in the United States Army under Jefferson and Madison, all through this period he was taking a pension from the government of Spain to derail the policies that he was supposed to be enforcing on behalf of the United States government. And one other thing that these historians established, it was they who pointed out to us for the first time that in the summer of 1810, which is halfway through Madison's first term in the White House, Madison sent a number of agents to the Spanish colonies on various assignments of one sort or another. And in fact, Madison sent agents to Buenos Aires, Chile, Cuba, Florida, Mexico, and Venezuela. At this time, they're still part of the Spanish-American Empire. The problem is they might not be part of the Spanish-American Empire very much longer, depending on what happens. Now, the best known of these agents is somebody you've probably heard of. It's a man named Joel Robert Poinsett, who later became American Minister for Mexico in the 1820s, and he bought back a pot plant, which was then named for him, which is where the Poinsettia, or the Poinsettia, depending on how you pronounce that, that's why that bears that name. He was from South Carolina. Madison sent him into Chile. Eventually, he sort of became an informal advisor to a group of rebels there against the Spanish government. Not much happened there. Chile had not established independence at that particular point in time. But Joel Roberts points it as certainly the best known of these agents. But I don't want to talk about him today, because of far greater importance of the agents that Madison sent to Cuba, Florida, and Mexico. Now, these are regions that either border on or are adjacent to the United States, and they were beginning their rebellions against Spanish rule, and those rebellions in fact also initiate the events which in the fullness of time will lead to the incorporation of many of these territories, with the exception of Cuba, into the United States, how the borderlands become part of the Republic. These processes in fact start in 1810, when Madison himself annexed the Spanish province of West Florida to the Union. Now, here we're talking about what is the Gulf Coast of the states of Alabama and Mississippi. And in fact, last year was the 200th anniversary of the rebellion of the West Floridian settlers against Spanish authority and the American annexation. You didn't read much about it in the newspapers, I'm guessing. It's not a headline event, but there are a number of descendants of people who actually took part in that rebellion. They're still in the Baton Rouge region. Now, Baton Rouge at this point was actually not part of the state of Louisiana. It was part of the Spanish colony of West Florida. And I went down to a conference there last fall, 1810, and I was surprised to sort of meet people whose great-great-great-grandparents had in fact taken part in these. And they sort of say some things to you, and they come out of the family law, and they say, what do you know about that? I didn't actually know that. It's not in the documentary record anywhere, but it may be part of somebody's family law. Madison started this process by annexing West Florida. The process continues through the annexation of East Florida in 1819, and then culminates in the acquisition of Texas and California between 1845 and 1848. Now, in all parts of the Spanish borderlands, it became very clear that Madison's agents that he sent in the summer of 1810 all became very closely involved in these rebellions against Spanish rule. So much so, in fact, that it started to look like Madison must have sent these agents into these Spanish colonies for the express purpose of overthrowing the Spanish government there in order to expand the boundaries of the Republic. And that Madison might have done something like this seemed quite plausible. After all, in the early 19th century, the Jefferson administration actually laid out a claim to East Florida, West Florida, and Texas. In other words, it was part of the diplomatic agenda of the United States while Madison and Jefferson were controlling the government of Washington. They had diplomatic claims that, in fact, stretched East Florida to the Rio Grande. They said by international law, by the interpretation of various treaties and agreements and things like this, that the United States had a legitimate claim to these territories, and the Spanish should get out, and these territories should become part of the United States. In the case of East Florida, which is now the peninsula of Florida, the present-day state of Florida, with the boundary, I think, on the Appalachian River, the claim to East Florida was based on the fact that Spain and the United States had had a dispute in the 1790s, during the course of which the Spaniards had seized a great many American vessels. The United States said those procedures were illegal under international law, and the Spanish government owed the United States compensation for spoliation that violated neutrality. But in a moment of generosity, the United said, well, we don't care about the money, but if you give us East Florida, we'll wipe the book clean. For the rest of it, West Florida and Texas was based on a certain reading of the Louisiana Purchase Treaty of 1803. Which, of course, Jefferson had acquired from France. Napoleon had acquired Louisiana from Spain, and the Spanish said Louisiana extended from the Rio Grande to the Apalachicola River. The United States, well, said if that's what's in the treaty, if that's what we bought, we paid for it, it should be ours. So all that seemed, well, this is one way of looking at it, all that seemed was happening in the summer of 1810, that Madison was sending agents into territories the United States had claimed for itself as a matter of diplomatic and international record. And maybe all he was doing after the summer of 1810 was taking a few small steps, which might have realised this long-standing American foreign policy agenda. Now, I can only imagine the satisfaction that CIA historians, if I can call them that, experienced when they read about this. What I do find a little more difficult to imagine is how the historians of the Congressional Research Service didn't find this material. It's not as if it was obscure out of the way. You could read books about this sort of stuff. But leaving that aside, what's the picture I'm painting here? We have the father of the Constitution, as he is known, engaged in what looked like covert operations, apparently for the purpose of inciting rebellions against a government with which the United States was supposed to be at peace, which is the government of Spain, and that one of the consequences of these activities was to accelerate the expansion of the American Republic to its present continental borders. Now, as good Americans, I ask you, what better activity or justification can there be for covert operations? They are clearly in the national interest. And for that reason, Madison himself has come to occupy an honoured place in many of the writings of these scholars, polemicists, who wish to repudiate the findings of the Church Committee. One scholar, in fact, writes fondly of a character whom he calls, and I quote, the covert Madison, close quote. And he celebrates the Madison presidencies, and I quote again, as the golden age of covert operations, close quote, in American history. I bet they didn't tell you that in school, did they? Well, you can go and read this book where he lays it all out. And what it looks like we have here is the fourth president that would seem organized revolutions in countries with which the United States was at peace. He also broke the law. Because if this is what he did, this was against the law that was passed in 1794, called the Neutrality Act, which made it a crime subject to fine and imprisonment for anybody who organized on American soil a hostile activity against the government with which the United States at peace. Madison was in Congress at that time, and he voted for that law. And Madison voted for the Neutrality Act of 1794. He doesn't seem to have observed it very closely when he was president a few years later. So, in fact, what he did, he violated the law of the United States. And all the time, he lied to the newspapers and to foreign governments about what he was doing. And in doing that, Madison became the first serious practitioner in American history of the art that we know today as, quote, plausible presidential denial, close quote. For example, I don't know, I may be speaking out of line here, but the recent attempt to remove Osama bin Laden failed. Would the president have said, oh, I knew nothing about that, with just a few rogue agents going off the agenda. But yeah, we've seen occasions like this when presidents of the United States in the 20th century have behaved in this way. Well, all these historians are saying this is how Madison acted when he was president. And better still, there were no congressional investigations into these activities. Nobody talked about impeaching Madison for violating the Constitution or the law. So the agency historians were sort of pretty happy with these results. They could justify covert operation on the ground. They almost formed a sort of part of the original intent of the way you interpret the Constitution. If the Founding Fathers did it, it sort of has to be right, doesn't it? That's sort of the argument. So that's how I came to sort of come up with the title. Now, what do we make of this? Well, there's no doubt that these writings have cast certain aspects of Madison's presidency into quite a startling and bold relief that we had not really quite appreciated before. But I'm supposed to be a professional historian. I'm supposed to be producing what is the definitive edition of all Madison's papers and writings. These arguments about covert activities pose three very serious problems for me that I must deal with in the course of putting together the definitive edition of Madison's papers. One simply is this argument obviously anachronistic and possibly tendentious? I think I'm right, the rain's come. After all, it's not very sound practice to take ideas and values from the middle of the 20th century and plonk them down 150 years later, and say this is how we explain the behaviour of people in that period. And of course, these people obviously have an agenda. So the question is, have they cooked the books, so to speak? So as a professional historian, you have to just ask, is this good history? Does it pass muster by the sort of standards of evidence that historians are normally expected to follow? Now, the second problem that's posed for me is rather a difficult one. What do I do about these episodes in Madison's presidency when I come to edit these periods in Madison's life, particularly 1810, 1811, 1812, that period? What do I say about the documents that will appear in those papers? And this is not a trivial question. In my worst nightmares, I wrote something about this in one of the volume of Madison papers, and then some Supreme Court justice reads that, and he then decides to base a legal opinion or an argument before the Supreme Court based on. And he said, "Look, this is what the Founding Fathers said." And I'm not making this up. If you go and look at some Supreme Court decisions, you do find justices of the Supreme Court using the modern vision of the faith of Daniel Madison to bolster their opinions. So, who knows what I say might have serious consequences. That leads me to the possibility, well, maybe I should say nothing about these things at all. Just pretend the problem doesn't exist, that I'm neutral towards the whole thing. But that struck me as not being a very useful or realistic strategy. And it's not a useful strategy for the reasons that I sort of already mentioned. There is discussion of this stuff in Madison's papers. They're going to be published. Some of them now have been published. And there's a lot of books out there which interpret these documents the way that I just described it. For me to appear neutral to the point of pretending this problem didn't exist in our understanding of Madison's presidency struck me as, well, seriously reducing the value of a modern edition of the Madison Papers as a research and reference tool for future generations of historians. And the third problem this poses for an interpretation of Madison is how do we relate this problem a rather ruthless, cynical, and immoral Madison who pursued illegal and aggressive policies towards the Spanish borderlands, how do we relate that picture of Madison to the more familiar picture of Madison's presidencies that's enshrined in the books that you read in high school or college? And this, of course, we come to the more familiar Madison that you know about, the man who sort of fumbled and stumbled around, made bad foreign policy mistakes in his terms in the White House. We all know that Madison's years in the White House were not exactly the high point of his life. If anything, it was the low point of his life in some sense. And then he went on to compound those blunders by totally mismanaging the War of 1812 against Great Britain. This is what you read about in the textbooks. The executive Madison, who was pushed into a war that he never wanted, then mismanaged to the extent that even to this day he remains the only president in American history who's ever been driven from the nation's capital by an invading army, which he was, of course, when the British took Washington in August 1814. And this is the Madison you're going to be reading or hearing, I think, quite a bit about in the next few years. We're starting next year, it's the bicentennial of the War of 1812. But I'm betting that the New York Times will not run a daily editorial and think piece or op-ed piece on the events of the War of 1812 in the way that they are doing for the Civil War. If you read the New York Times on a day like that, you see that every day. There is some essay, usually by a historian, on some facet of the Civil War, because it's the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of that war. Well, we're coming up to the 200th War of 1812, and I suppose the media might do a bit about that, but probably not nearly to the extent they're doing about the Civil War. So we seem to have, anyway, two divergent pictures of Madison. One a totally incompetent and bumbler in the White House. Yet this is another picture of a man who's ruthless, cynical, amoral in his dealings with Spanish territory that surrounds the United States. Now, one way of sort of resolving this is to say, well, Madison suffered from some sort of schizophrenia. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, and he didn't. But I think that's not an answer to that problem. I don't think you can sort of say that Madison. We're using the term schizophrenia sort of lightly and metaphorically here, but there's no evidence that Madison sort of ever lost grasp of his sanity or his perceptions of reality to have ever behaved in that sort of way. And I suspect it's probably the historians who've got Madison wrong rather than Madison behaving in the way the historians have talked about. But my larger point is, well, I think we need to deal with Madison's activities towards Spain and the Spanish borderland very carefully. Because if we get this wrong, we're likely not to understand many things about Madison's presidency itself. I think it is a central problem that we need to sort of have some full answer to understand what sort of president Madison was. So that was one reason why I wrote this book here, to try and sort this stuff out. Because I found out more stuff about it than I ever legitimately stuffed into a volume of the Madison Papers. Though if I did that, it would be turned into my own personal papers rather than the papers of a founding father. So I decided to write a book about it. And so we now turn to the question, well, what sense did I make of this problem? What was Madison trying to do with all these agents that he sent into these Spanish territories? Now, central to any discussion of this business is what happened in West Florida in 1810. That's the most important of these events. It is the one episode that did lead, during Madison's terms in the White House, to the overthrow of a Spanish government. And after the Spanish government was overthrown, Madison annexed West Florida, or most of West Florida, to the United States.
Now, if you go and look at the historical literature on this, they will tell you that Madison sent two agents into Spanish West Florida. One was named William Wyckoff, who was an American planter who lived in Spanish territory in Baton Rouge. The other was a man named George Matthews, who had been a three-term governor of Georgia in the 1790s. And we'll say a bit more about Matthews in another context later. Now, their purpose, their assignment was, according to some of the books you can read about this, was to encourage the American settlers in West Florida to rebel, to declare their independence against Spanish rule. And there were about 15,000 American settlers living in Spanish territory at this period. In fact, Americans outnumbered native-born Iberians in this region. So sort of all the demographics favored the United States, in a sense, rather than it did the governing classes of Spanish officials. So Madison sent these agents to incite these people to rebel against the Spanish, get them to declare their independence. They did this in September 1810, and when Madison received the news in October 1810, he promptly annexed West Florida to the United States. He concealed this from the public for about 2 months. You've got to remember how slow communications took 3 weeks from a letter to get from the Gold Coast up to Washington. It didn't sort of hit the papers on the East Coast until December 1810, right at the end of the year. Madison announced it in the State of the Union address at the end of 1810, saying, well, guess what, guys, we've annexed West Florida. By which time, American military forces had taken effective possession of much of the territory of West Florida. Now, the West Florida episode is the most extensively studied example of what some people think is an early American covert operation. In fact, I just found out last week that someone had published another book about it about 3 weeks ago, about the West Florida rebellion, sort of maybe trying to cash in, albeit a few months late, on the bicentennial of that event. And many historians say this, and the agency historians, if I can call them that, are in unanimous praise of Madison's handling of the West Florida business. They say, if this is how you want to overthrow a foreign government, Madison provides you with a blueprint of how to do it, because it worked, the Spanish government was overthrown, West Florida became part of the United States. No problem, or so it would seem. Now, of course, having set the problem up this way, you're not going to be surprised when I next tell you that almost anything you can read on this book, on the subject in any book, including the book that was published 3 weeks ago, is dead wrong. Certainly, Madison sent the agents in question into West Florida, but he did not order them to foment rebellion against Spain, and he explicitly ruled out the idea that the American settlers there should declare their independence against or from Spanish rule. Now, one problem here is that no historian has actually looked, or they've not paid sufficient attention to the problem, of why Madison decided to act in this way when he did. When you explain historical problems, it's not just sort of explore possible motives that people might or might not give for taking a particular action. After all, people should be suspect when they explain their motives to you. And one way of dealing with this problem is you ask the question, why did you do this at a particular point in time, as opposed to a week earlier, or 3 months later, or 2 years later? Timing actually matters when you explain why people act, and it matters when you have to explain why political actors, heads of state, governments, act in the way they do. And we know precisely when Madison took all these decisions. It was the week between the 13th and the 18th of June 1810. In that five-day period, he made the decision to send all those agents into the Spanish American colonies that I've just been talking about. So why act then, in the middle of June? Well, by the first week of June or so, Madison had received the last set of dispatches that were to be written by an American diplomat from Spain, a man named George Irving. As Irving fled before the advance of Napoleon's armies in the Iberian Peninsula. We've got to remember here the background, if you And I can't digress here with the entire international history of the Napoleonic Wars, but that is the background against which this all plays out. But some of you will probably know that in 1808, Napoleon invaded Spain. And he plonked his brother, a man named Joseph Bonaparte, on the throne of Spain. He imprisoned the legitimate king of Spain, an unfortunate character, Ferdinand VII, one of the worst kings that Spain's ever had, but never mind. He jailed him in a castle in the south of France for the next 6 years. And he put his brother on the throne. This provoked a guerrilla war against, this is how the term guerrilla comes from. It was a very nasty war. And Napoleon, in fact, had to conquer Spain in order to make the rule of his brother stick. But by the spring of 1810, all the signs are is that Napoleon is going to conquer Spain. The legitimate government, or the resistance of the rebels that's left in Spain that are acting in the name of the imprisoned king, have been driven to the port of Cadiz on the Atlantic coast of Spain. And they will be followed by a Spanish army, which then laid siege to Cadiz. And this is why Irving, who was following the Spanish government around, he decided at that point, after he wrote that last dispatch, he would get on a boat and come back to the United States, because he said, it's all over. Once they take this one town, Napoleon will have conquered Spain. The Spanish government, the Bourbon dynasty of Spain, will have gone. Spain, and by implication, its American empire, will then become part of Napoleon's much larger empire. That's what Madison is hearing and thinking by the first week of June. As at the same time this was coming, this news was coming from Europe, there was also news coming from Venezuela that it had issued a declaration saying that the Venezuelan people will never submit to be ruled by a French king. This is a prelude to, in fact, Declaration of Independence, and Venezuela is the first major South American country to declare independence from Spain. It takes place on July 5th, 1811, a year later from the point I'm talking about, but it had a long prelude, goes back 12 or 13 months before that, and the declaration of a junta in Caracas, Venezuela, saying we will not consent to be ruled by a French king, is one of the stages which led to Venezuela's declaring its independence. News of that also reaches Washington at the same time. So what does Madison conclude when the stuff starts to hit the newspapers? It's coming in from dispatches, letters from people in Europe, from Irving himself, as he comes back. He concludes that the days of the Kingdom of Spain are numbered. And if the days of the Kingdom of Spain are numbered, so too are the days of the Spanish-American Empire, which has been around since the time of Christopher Columbus. In other words, the Spanish-American Empire is about to dissolve under the pressure of these events. Now, of course, we know, as we have the advantage of hindsight, this was not quite right. Napoleon did not win in Spain. Ultimately, the Spanish problem turned into the so-called Spanish ulcer, which contributed not a little to the final defeat of Napoleon, and the Spanish Empire doesn't really finally sort of implode or explode until a period really about 1817, 1822. But 1810, 1811, things look very different. Madison believes he's looking at a process which would be only a matter of weeks and months, not years. By the end of 1810, for example, he doesn't expect there to be a legitimate Bourbon royalist government in Spain that will become part of the French Empire if Napoleon wins that war. So Madison has a problem. What's he do if that's what he thinks is going to happen? If he does nothing at all and simply waits on events, he runs the risk that American interests, or the claims that he and Jefferson have laid out in the early 19th century, are going to go by default because the United States has failed to act in ways that will make good on them. Either what will happen here is that Joseph Bonaparte will conquer all Spain and he'll say, well, I am now ruler of the Spanish-American Empire and I don't believe the United States has good claims to these territories. They are part of my empire and I'm going to treat them that way. Now, everybody knew as Napoleon, this is, he plonked his family members on various thrones throughout Europe. Spain was not the only nation in which he did this. Everybody knew that Napoleon was a bully in all sorts of ways, and nowhere was he more of a bully than dealing with members of his own family. He put them on the thrones of his other European countries, not so they could rule these countries in the interests of their populations. They would rule to serve the larger interests of France, which is worth badgering the camp of troops and money and things like that to fund Napoleon's military ambitions. So if those territories, the Gulf Coast territories, become part of a French-controlled empire, that's a security nightmare for the United States. The United States thought they might have escaped that sort of problem when Napoleon sold Louisiana to the United States in 1803. But here we are 7 or 8 years later. If Napoleon's brother says, I control the rest of the Gulf Coast, potentially that's a problem. And if that were to happen, what might Great Britain do? Which, of course, Britain is committing everything it's got to fight this war against Napoleon. Might the British not seize on various Spanish colonies to prevent them from falling into the hands of Napoleon and his family? Now, this is not a bogeyman which can be what I'm just conjuring out to try and find some sort of evidence or reason for a decision that Madison took that he really wanted to take for other reasons. It was quite plausible. People talked about it this time. We've got to remember that East and West Florida, between 1763 and 1783, had in fact been part of the British Empire. They went back to Spain in 1783. But after the 7 Years' War, the Florida Peninsula and the Gulf Coast became part of the American colonies. The British had been there before, and it was not totally unreasonable to think, well, circumstances might arise when the British might feel the need to come there again. And the easiest way for the British to stop some other power taking over Spain's Latin American colonies was to control the strategic points that give Europeans access to Spanish America. And two of those points are Cuba and the Florida Peninsula. One reason why the Spanish built a fort at St. Augustine was to control the approaches to the Caribbean Sea and to northern and south America. So that's another possibility. Now, those are the possibilities. And to deal with this is one reason why Madison sent agents into these Spanish American colonies. He simply needed to know what was going on. Information is in short supply. There are no American diplomatic representatives in the Spanish colonies. The Spanish did not admit diplomats from other countries into their colonies. They didn't think about those things in those ways. You're not going to get any information out of Spain, given the chaos that's going on there. Madison, he needs information in order to deal with what is potentially quite a serious situation. Now, Madison, when you look at the instructions he gave to these people, he did not order his agents to foment rebellion. He did not, I stress not, encourage the province to declare its independence. Now, why? For Madison, the problem is not the Spanish regime on the Gulf Coast. Madison assumes that regime would simply become defunct if Napoleon conquers Spain. That regime, or the representatives, the colonial representatives of that regime, the Spanish governors of West Florida and East Florida and their officials, they would have nobody to report to. They represent nothing anymore. They're going to be swept aside by the course of history. Madison is not worried about the Spanish officials. What he is worried about is the possibility of a vacuum emerging on the Gulf Coast if events play out in Spain the way he thinks they do. The question is, nature abhors a vacuum. What's going to fill that vacuum? That, I think, is the question that Madison is worrying about. Now, his response to this was to instruct his agents to talk to the American settlers and persuade them to organize a convention. And the purpose of that convention was not to overthrow the Spanish regime, imprison the Spanish officials or anything like that. The convention, on the assumption that the Spanish government or a legitimate Spanish government no longer existed because of what happened in Spain, they were to issue an invitation to the United States to make good on the claim that, in fact, it had acquired West Florida by virtue of the Louisiana Purchase. And that fact, you know, what they're saying is right, the United States claims West Florida. The Spanish are about to disappear. Now is the time, if ever there is a time, for the United States to say, well, if we claim West Florida, we better do something about it in this set of circumstances. And conventions, you've got to remember here what role conventions play in Anglo-American political history. If you know anything about English political history, conventions emerge at particular points in English political history to deal with sticky situations when there's an interregnum, where government is disputed, where government has ceased to exist. How do you get from sort of chaos to orderly procedures? This happens a number of times in English history. The best known one, probably to us all, and certainly one that was best known to Americans at this time, was the Convention Parliament of 1688-1689. After the Glorious Revolution, which drove off James II, there was a Convention Parliament. The Convention Parliament offered the throne to William and Mary, and the condition of William and Mary accepting the British throne, the English throne, was consenting to the English Bill of Rights in 1689. Our conventions emerge in crises like these to bridge collapse of government. And remember, the American Revolution itself was preceded by a number of conventions which go through the motions of dissolving allegiance to the British regime in order to transfer it to a new form of government. So that's, I think, what Madison was thinking of. We're going to have a political vacuum on the Gulf Coast. The settlers ought to organize themselves. They ought to send an invitation to Washington saying, now is the time for the United States to step in. Now, that, I think, is a long way from sort of thinking about overthrowing the Spanish government, accomplishing this means, this end by violent means. So I don't think Madison was thinking of subverting and overthrowing the Spanish government. Instead, what he was trying to do was to come up with the least disruptive and the least violent or the least radical way to protect the position that the United States had purchased West Florida in 1803. And that now the United States should be regarded as the next government in this territory. Now, the problem was that this was not what happened. Often it is in history. The problem is what happened was not what was supposed to happen. The West Florida members totally misread the script that they were supposed to receive from Washington, and its members panicked. They panicked because they thought the Spanish authorities were going to send an army from Cuba which would crush them. Then they'd all be sort of taken off to Cuba and jailed in the Morro Castle, which guards the entrance to Havana, after which they might meet a very nasty fate, which doesn't bear thinking about. So they panicked. And in order to sort of head off what they regarded as suppression from Cuba, they issued a Declaration of Independence in order to force the United States to take the actions which Madison actually didn't want to take at all. But when he found out what had happened, Madison promptly annexed West Florida. But in doing so, he did not suppress the Spanish government. He suppressed the government of American rebel settlers. In fact, all through this period, in the last month of 1810, a Spanish garrison remained in control of Mobile, which is the largest sort of port town on that part of the Gulf Coast. And Madison, in fact, issued instructions to these people that they were not to attack Spanish territory, or Spanish subjects, or Spanish officials. And what he's saying is, I don't want a war with Spain over this. But he has to sort of suppress the government, the settler government of West Florida, in order to make good the claim that the United States really should control this territory. If he doesn't do that, and this government then sort of sets up and says, we are the effective government here, what happens to the American claim that it had purchased West Florida and really should be part of the territory of the United States? This sort of situation led to a rather ticklish and embarrassing confrontation when Madison sends the American forces in to West Florida at the end of 1810. By this time, the West Floridians had left their own government. There was a man who was president of the Independent Republic of West Florida for all the 76 days it existed. His name was Fuller Skipper. He was in fact a Virginian, and his father, Henry Skipper, was one of Jefferson's brothers-in-law. He was a well-known Virginian. Madison knew perfectly well who he was. But Skipper was actually appalled at what Madison had done. He did not want to be annexed to the United States, and didn't think he had to submit to this. In fact, we know, got the copies of them, he drafted two extremely abusive letters to Madison at the end of 1810, complaining of the unreasonable tyranny that Madison was about to force on the settlers of West Florida. He thought better of it, suppressed the letters, and he never sent them to Madison, so Madison never read them. But more importantly, the point I'm making about this is that the episode in West Florida, not only did things happen there that weren't supposed to happen, other things happened as well. And the most serious of these things is the West Florida Convention, in the course of establishing its control over much of the territory of West Florida. They attacked the Spanish fort. They attacked the Spanish fort of Baton Rouge. And in the course of it, they killed some Spaniards. And in particular, they killed the grandson of the previous Spanish governor of West Florida, which everybody agreed was very nasty, and where we're in Washington was very nasty. I don't know if the locals down there thought it was so bad, but those developments gave what Madison was trying to do quite a different cast. And the result was, in fact, that Madison acquired or he annexed West Florida by violence and bloodshed, which I don't think was what he wanted to do. And of course, if you're not an American, if you're a British, if you're Spanish, if you're French, and you're looking at this from the outside, what do you see? An American army going in, seizing territory, annexing territory of a nation that the United States was supposed to be at peace with, and what other conclusion would you draw up that the President of the United States must have masterminded all this? How else could it have happened if he had not done something like this? Now, Madison would hardly dispel that charge by turning around and saying, oh, no, you're wrong. This is not what I intended to happen at all. You don't find states making arguments like that. Because if you made that sort of argument, you then have to say, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. He couldn't say to the Spanish, well, I really thought, you know, by then you weren't even going to be on the scene. So I don't have to worry about you. He didn't say that. You can't imagine that he would have said that. And he never tried to come up with justifications like this. He was simply stuck with the consequences of what he'd done at that point, and he has to live with them. So I think the point about this is that West Florida is not a successful example of a covert operation. If anything, it's almost the opposite of that. Because nothing that happened there was according to plan. So I think Madison made his calculation as he was going about this business in West Florida. But I think he also understood very well that he had to protect the United States from the consequences of what he had just done. There were going to be international repercussions from this. The Spanish haven't gone away. They're not likely to be happy. The British, which are allied with the Royalist government of Spain, they're not going to be happy. The United States has attacked the territory of one of the British government's allies. Madison still has to think about what might the British do, for example. How might they respond? They might sort of still decide to step in on the Gulf Coast. They might still decide to seize East Florida. They might still decide to seize Cuba, that sort of thing. So to anticipate this, Madison, in January 1811, asked Congress to pass what becomes known in American history as the so-called No Transfer Resolution. It's quite a famous document in the history of American foreign policy at this period. But basically what the No Transfer Resolution provided for, it's allowed the President to occupy East Florida. It gave him the authority to do this. It gave him the authority to use American forces to do this in the event of one of two contingencies. One was that a foreign power would step in to seize East Florida. In other words, if a British fleet showed up off the Florida Capes, the United States would step in before the British could step in. The other contingency was that the United States would take East Florida if the local authority, now what they mean by it is the local ruling Spanish authority, decides that it will surrender voluntarily that territory to the United States. That's the essence of the No Transfer Resolution. Well, that's famous. It becomes a sort of core idea in the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, that European powers cannot transfer American territory around themselves. It's behind Monroe's argument that the New World is off limits to European imperial moves. This is an early antecedent of the Monroe Doctrine. But the second contingency is that local authorities might turn over Spanish territory to the United States. It was not a figment of their imagination. In fact, towards the end of 1810, the Spanish governor of West Florida, he too thinking that Madison, Napoleon might conquer France, had hinted that under those circumstances he would surrender West Florida to the United States rather than the surrender to France. So there was something out there for them to think about. So I think in going to Congress and asking what becomes the no transfer resolution, Madison is trying to provide the sort of contingent circumstances which might let the United States step into East Florida if things work out the way I've just described. So on that, after the no transfer resolution is passed, Madison sends two agents into East Florida. One of them is George Matthews, whom he'd sent previously into West Florida. The other is a man named John Key, who is one of the dubious characters who operates on the sort of Spanish American frontier at this time. He later became a congressman from Alabama. So he sent those two agents in to implement the provisions of the no transfer resolution if it should be necessary to do so. Now, all historians of American foreign policy regard the wording of the no transfer resolution as so broad and so vague. They say, well, it must have been written to allow Madison to overthrow the government of East Florida. How else to explain why you have such a broad and amorphous resolution passing Congress at that time? But to argue that, I think, is to claim, or for historians to claim, that they knew what was going to happen before the participants themselves actually knew what was going to happen, which is not the way I think the sort of historian should try to operate. So I think we should suspend the clarity of hindsight and sort of say, well, what did Madison mean by the no transfer resolution? Maybe he meant, or what he thought it meant, was that it meant no more and no less than what it exactly seemed to say at the time it was passed. The problem was, in East Florida, events did not work out there just as they did not work out in West Florida. Matthews and McKee went down to the Gulf Coast, they contacted the Spanish officials, and they said, well, how about it? Would you be prepared to sort of surrender East Florida to the United States in the event of France conquering Spain? And by this time, we're into the spring of 1811, and the situation is a bit different. Spain had not fallen. There were signs that there was a resistance moving organizing a better resistance to the French invasion. In fact, the Spanish have summoned an imperial parliament, which meets in Cadiz. They're starting to organize a much more extensive resistance to the French invasion. And, of course, Spanish officials are a little wary of American officials showing up on the Gulf Coast in the spring of 1811 saying, hey, look, we've got nothing, can't refuse, sort of thing. They're a bit suspicious of the United States after what happened to Matthews. So they say, no, we're not going to do that. So they rebuff Matthews and McKee. Now, this led Matthews, who's the most important agent here, to come to the conclusion that the local authorities in East Florida would not consent to turn the province over to the United States until they were replaced with a local authority of what we might call a more willing disposition. And Matthews had some ideas about what a willing local authority might look like. You've got to remember he was a three-term governor of Georgia. He'd served three terms as governor of Georgia. So he is well known in the region. He is a man who has extensive political contacts and acquaintances throughout the region. He's also one of the biggest land speculators in American history. A rather shady character. Some of you may have heard of the Yazoo land frauds in the 1790s. Great financial land scandals. Matthews was up to his eyeballs in Yazoo land scandals. In fact, he signed many of the acts that went through the Georgia legislature in the 1790s that had made this possible. He was actually from Virginia originally. I think he actually knew Madison's father. Matthews was born in Virginia. I don't remember reading something. He actually did visit Montpelier once. Madison knew him a bit, but he was also an acquaintance of Madison's father. He was an older man. But among his acquaintances were a number of Georgian planters who had moved across the St. Mary's River into Spanish territory in East Florida to develop plantations there. It was prime plantation land. It's on a It's on a river which connects to the Atlantic Ocean, that sort of thing. And many of these Georgians had taken up Spanish citizenship. Now, you had to do this. The Spanish were not averse to American settlers coming and settling on Spanish territory at this period. But they said to Americans, if you come into our territory to trade and to do business, we require you to take an oath of allegiance to the King of Spain. And that was, in fact, that oath of allegiance was a requirement to hold a legitimate land title under Spanish authority in this period. And many Americans took these oaths of allegiance. A few years ago, it was discovered in the Spanish archives, one American character in particular had taken an oath of allegiance to Spain in the late 1780s. Do you have any idea who I'm talking about? The most plausible person on the face of the earth. You would never suspect a million years of taking an oath of allegiance to the King of Spain. That man later became a president of the United States.
Andrew Jackson.
Yes, Andrew Jackson. Which may explain something about why Jackson was pretty rough on the Spaniards. Andrew Jackson. So that gives you some idea that, you know, it was not uncommon for even the most unlikely sounding Americans to take an oath of that sort. So Matthews came up with a brilliant idea of why don't we replace the local Spanish government with an authority created of American-born Spanish settlers who can then be persuaded to sign a treaty with Matthews turning over East Florida to the United States. And that, after all, is precisely what Matthews tried to do after August 1811. So after that period, you find the emergence of a so-called Patriot Party in East Florida. It was headed by a Georgian-born Spanish subject who rejoiced under the very Scottish name of John Houston McIntosh. He became the head of this leader, this group, and their idea was that they are the ones who Matthews wants to turn East Florida over to the United States. Now, in fairness to Matthews, he did not conceal what he was doing with the administration of Washington. He wrote letters back saying, I think, you know, we have to do this, but I can't do it alone. I need help. And he says, the government should send me arms and ammunition to help me do this. And he says, you don't have to worry about this. I'm going to be so discreet. There's no danger that the United States is ever going to be blamed for this operation. He actually said this. The administration made absolutely no response to this. Now, Matthews sent four sets of letters asking for this across this period. But Washington ignored them all. They sent no communications to Matthews at all from about the middle of 1811 through to the spring of 1812. Nonetheless, Matthews went about his self-assigned task. The contingencies in the No Transfer Resolution said he could use American armed forces to achieve its goals. So Matthews trots out and he seeks out the American Army commander on the St. Mary's River, a man named Major Laval. And Laval won't play ball. Laval shared quarters with Matthews for a while. He didn't like him at all. It's like sort of oil and water, chalk and cheese, or whatever method you want to use. Laval thought Matthews was a very dubious character, up to no good. So when Matthews says, will you give me some American troops so I can do certain things, Laval simply says, no, I don't think you're authorized to do those sorts of things. I'm not going to give you my troops. The naval officer, a man named Hugh Campbell, around the region of Savannah, he was sort of persuaded that Matthews could do this, and he agrees to turn a few American gunboats over to the command of Matthews. So Matthews put this all together, and in March 1812, he and the Patriot forces, accompanied by U.S. gunboats from the United States Navy, attacked the Spanish garrison on Amelia Island, and forced that garrison to surrender. The Patriots then reconstituted themselves as a government of East Florida. They negotiated a treaty with Matthews. Matthews put this treaty in the mail to Washington, and he writes to Madison and Monroe, Secretary of State, saying, there you are, I've got you, East Florida. Here it is, the treaty. I'm handing it to you on a platter. So the next move is up to Madison. What's he going to do? Now, to everybody's surprise, Madison turned around, and in the first week of April, he says, No, I'm not taking East Florida. You've disobeyed the law. You disobeyed my instructions. Nothing that we sent to you by way of instructions justified this. What you did was immoral and wrong. We will not do it. And for that reason, East Florida doesn't become part of the United States until 1819, 2 years after Madison leaves the prisons. Now, at the time, this is the spring of 1812, Madison made only one remark about what Matthews was doing in East Florida. And I just quote something from it was in the letter that he wrote about 3 years later, Jefferson. He said, and I quote, "In East Florida, Matthews has been playing a tragic comedy in the face of common sense as well as his instructions. His extravagances place us in the most distressing dilemma." Close quote. Now, you might think, well, that's an end of it. Madison said this was illegal, this was wrong, and that was why he repudiated the offer of East Florida as it had been presented to him by George Matthews. Now, the problem with this is that no American historian has ever believed that this explained Madison's actions. And they don't take Madison's own word for three basic reasons. They think Madison's not telling the truth from that letter to Jefferson. And the three reasons are, one, well, they said Madison was trying to do just what he'd done in West Florida. He'd overthrown the government of West Florida, therefore he was also trying to overthrow the government of East Florida. The two things are basically the same sort of exercise. We know he subverted the government in East Florida, of West Florida, so why wasn't he trying to subvert the government in East Florida? That's one argument. The second argument is that the administration certainly knew what Matthews said he wanted to do. The letters are there in the State Department archives. They didn't respond to them. So historians said, well, they didn't tell him to stop it. Therefore, they must have intended for him to go ahead. They failed to stop him. That's the equivalent of giving a green light to go ahead and do it. That's the second argument. The third argument is that Madison would have accepted the annexation of East Florida from the hands of George Matthews had it not been for an unfortunate accident of timing. Now, what they mean by this, and there's a little complicated here, but Matthews did this in March 1812. He overthrew, he attacked the Spanish garrison on Amelia Island and did all this in March 1812. At exactly the time that he was doing this, Madison sent a bunch of letters to Congress from a British spy named John Henry. And why Madison did this was he found information a few weeks earlier that the British government in Canada had sent Captain John Henry into the United States at the end of Jefferson's presidency in 1808-1809 during the embargo crisis, the final event of Jefferson's presidency. And Henry's mission was to assess the prospects from the British point of view of New England seceding from the United States. Madison got this evidence the British had sent an agent to subvert the government of the United States, and he sent it to Congress in March 1809. He did so to stir up feeling against the British. But while this is all going on, he's trying to prepare the nation for war against Britain. And of course, the War of 1812 against Great Britain is declared in June 1812. This is part of the lead up to the events of the War of 1812. Now, the problem with this is that with Matthews in East Florida, Madison was caught, or he seemed to be guilty, of precisely the offence which he was trying to impute to the British government in sending Henry's letters to Congress. And when you start looking at it from the point of view of political morality and international law, it's difficult to have this both ways. Madison cannot say it's all right for me to send an agent into East Florida to overthrow the government there, but it's wrong for the British to send an agent to New England who have overthrown the government of the United States there. You can't have that one both ways. So that was the dilemma that, in fact, Matthews' actions posed for Madison by the spring of 1812. And this is what historians say. Well, he would have taken East Florida had it not for the unfortunate accident. Therefore, he had to disavow the agents of Matthews, actions of Matthews. This is where we get Madison as the first practitioner of what's known as plausible presidential denial. Was Madison, I know nothing about that man. You know, he didn't do anything. And historians have never given Madison the benefit of the doubt. They say he must have intended this to happen. There's no other way of explaining it. Now, there is no doubt the problem of time is unfortunate. Can you imagine the next meeting between the British Minister of Washington and Madison after this has taken place? Madison, can you imagine Madison saying, well, we've got evidence of this British spy trying to go through the government of the United States. And the British Minister would say, well, that's very interesting, Mr. President. It so happens we've got evidence. And the British government actually knew what Matthews had done in Florida slightly before the American government did. We got evidence you sent a spy. You can imagine what that conversation came to look like, or sound like, and you can imagine why Madison would never have wanted to have had that conversation. Unless you pretend that Madison was so stupid and so thoughtless that he planned to go to war with Great Britain and Spain at exactly the same time, and he arranged this to produce this outcome, I don't think he was actually that stupid. Things just didn't happen that way. I'm then in the position to say, well, how do I prove, or how can I suggest to you, that even if John Henry's letters had not existed, let's imagine that they never found the letters of John Henry, does that mean that Madison would have taken East Florida from Matthews under those circumstances? Now, that's a sort of hypothetical counterfactual, which never happened. And it's always very difficult to prove a counterfactual. It's not easy. But I think there are two reasons which I think lead me to give Madison the benefit of the doubt here. One of the arguments is, of course, what he was trying to do in East Florida was exactly the same as what he was doing in West Florida. Now, in fact, that's not true. They are not the same sort of operation. They are different cases, different circumstances, slightly different policies. It doesn't follow, because of what he did in West Florida, he was trying to do the same in East Florida. The other, I think, is that the argument that he would have accepted East Florida is based on a fair degree of ignorance about how government in Washington actually operated on a day-to-day basis in the early 19th century. Now, commissioning an agent like Matthews, this is quite common. What happens is that the government department in question, in this case it's the State Department, the State Department writes a letter to the agent saying, you are to do X, Y, Z. It spells out what he is to do, and it says you have to report back to the government as you do it. And that we find that in the instructions to Matthews. That was normal practice. What was not normal practice was for the government to write further letters to that agent unless the policy was to be changed. And it is not normal practice to write letters to agents telling them not to do things that are not covered by their instructions, if you sort of pardon the double negatives in that. In other words, the sort of normal proceeding assumption was to an agent, here's your instructions. You are bound to follow them until you hear from us otherwise. And I think this explains the silence that ensued with respect to Matthews. After August 1811, Matthews hinted that his mission should be changed. In fact, I said, change my mission, send me guns, send me out, I'll do it. The response to this is total silence. And I think that total silence means not that they're giving them a green light to go ahead. What they're really saying is silence here means no. You are to stay bound by your original instructions. Now, you can say here, well, if that's the case, Madison was certainly guilty of a failure of oversight. And that's true, he was guilty of a failure of oversight because the agent in question went off the rails completely by the spring of 1812. He placed Madison in a very embarrassing situation. But the failure of oversight, I think, is not necessarily the same. It doesn't necessarily explain Madison's intentions at the time that he gave Matthews his instructions. So I'm inclined to give Madison the benefit of doubt that he said what he meant, and that when he disavowed Matthews, he did so for the reasons that he gave. Now, just to sort of move this on fairly quickly, I rather taxed your patience for probably longer than you would like, you might say, well, this is all very well. But a realist is cynic. Madison's not entitled to the benefit of doubt. It looks like he's caught red-handed. So I'd ask you to suspend that cynicism or that doubt for one moment longer, while we look at the third case of Madison's sending an agent into the Spanish borderlands. And that's the sending of an agent into Mexico. Or rather, if an agent turns out to be in Texas. But you've got to remember this time, Texas is part of Mexico. It's not part of the United States. It doesn't count out of the United States until 1845. Now, this Texan episode is better known in American history as the so-called Gutierrez-McGee raid. It's one of the first big filibusters against Spanish territory in the New World in the 19th century. McGee was a U.S. Army officer. He had been a U.S. Army officer. He in fact resigned. He was no longer in the U.S. Army when he did this. Gutierrez was a Mexican rebel against Spanish authority in the early days of Mexico's rebellion against the Spanish Empire. And eventually, an army 3,000 strong of Mexicans and Americans invaded Texas in 1813. In the spring of 1813, they captured San Antonio and set up a government there. And that government then issued a declaration of independence on the part of Texas against Spain. It drew up a constitution that organized a new government in San Antonio. And it was there for about 5 or 6 months. Eventually, the Spanish royals got sacked together and rounded all these people up and captured them back several months later. And the whole movement passed out of existence. Now, if you read histories of American foreign policy in this period, you will find nothing about this episode. An army of 3,000 people invading the Spanish territory in 1812, 1813. But if you go to school in Texas, you will learn about this. And the reason why you will learn about it is that, it takes place around San Antonio. And near San Antonio, of course, is the Alamo. And in fact, the filibustering force camped on the territory of the Alamo while it was getting ready to take San Antonio. And for that reason, Texans see this as a prelude to the Alamo. And they celebrate it accordingly. By the same token, of course, Mexicans see it as exactly the same way, and they have a very much more jaundiced attitude towards this. And it is an article of faith in most Mexican historians. They have not forgotten that as Mexico was trying to establish its independence from Spain in the early 19th century, what did the United States do to help them? Well, they say they sent an army which was trying to tear Texas away from Mexico. They haven't forgotten that, even today. Now, why are Mexicans skeptical about American good intentions here? Well, one reason at the centre of all these events is an American agent. Another of these agents that Madison has sent out in the summer of 1810. The name of this agent is William Shaler. He was, in fact, a merchant from Connecticut. Who travelled extensively around South America. Madison had met him earlier in the year, had some correspondence with him. And in 1810, Shaler was sent by Madison on two missions. One was to Cuba, and then one was to Mexico. And what happened was that Shaler, just as surely as Matthews had done in East Florida, becomes very deeply involved in this attempt to overthrow Spanish rule, to the point that by the spring of 1813, Shaler, in fact, displaces Gutierrez, who's the Mexican leader of this army, and tries to replace him with what he regards as a more amenable and more suitable Spanish-American leader, a man named Jose Alvarez de Toledo. The other thing about Shaler is that he left an enormous paper trail. While he was on this mission, he wrote about 150 letters to the State Department. Now, that's over a 30-month period. He's writing the State Department about 5 times a month, which is an extraordinary paper trail for this period. And these letters are very good letters. They're very interesting letters. And I think that actually the Shaler will apply to the state, to the CIA today on the grounds that he should be used as a covert agent. The CIA would say no. You don't leave a paper trail behind like this. You know, we're not in that sort of business. And the problem is that these letters convey an enormous amount of detailed information about what's happening in Texas at this time. And historians have looked at this and say, what's going on here? How could he possibly know all this stuff? And the answer they have is, well, he could have only known about this had he actually been involved in doing it. That's the only explanation we can see how he came up with all this. Now, historians have assumed that Shaler was behind the filibuster, and from that they have assumed that, well, if he was behind the filibuster, this must mean that Madison wanted to detach Texas from Mexico for the purposes of incorporating it into the United States at this period, just as he had. They think he tried to do this with Matthews in East Florida. And they base this on the contents of Shaler's letters back to the State Department and to the fact that Shaler knew the leaders of the rebellion. He did. He knew who they were. That's perfectly clear. But, and the but is important here, in coming up with this argument, historians never bothered to look at the instructions that the State Department gave to Shaler, because they're not in the State Department archives anywhere. You won't find a copy of the document that they wrote to Shaler anywhere in the National Archives of the United States. I found it a few years ago. It's lying in the bottom of a collection in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And nobody really knew it was there. And I was also aided in this a few years after that through the agents of a sort of the assistance of a manuscript collector in New Haven. We came across Shaler's diaries and letter books on his Mexican mission. And that's an enormous trove of information that wasn't available to historians before. So if you look at what's in Shaler's diaries and letter books, and you look at his instructions, you in fact come up with a completely different picture of what he was supposed to be about. So what was Shaler supposed to be about? Well, his instructions make absolutely no mention of fomenting rebellion, overthrowing the government of Texas, overthrowing the government of Mexico, or annexing Texas to the United States. None of these things are in Shaler's diaries or in his instructions. What he was supposed to do, he was first sent to Cuba. And his instructions for the Cuban regime was to find out where the allegiance of the population of Cuba would lie, on the assumption that the Spanish government is about to collapse. The Mayate wants to know, where do the sympathies of the Cubans lie? Will they favour joining France? Will they go with the British? Or would they like to join the United States? One of Shaler's instructions is to see whether Cuba wants to join the United States at this point in time, after the Spanish-American Empire has collapsed. Now, what Shaler actually determined about this was that Cubans were more favourable to the Americans than they were to the British or to the French, but he said they don't want to join the United States. And he thought it didn't really matter that much whether they want to join the United States or not. But after doing that, Shaler was next supposed to go to Veracruz in Mexico, and he was then to go from Veracruz to the region, Mexico City, where the heart of the rebellion against the Spanish government was taking place. And if a successful rebel government set itself up, Shaler was then authorised to talk to this rebel government. He was supposed to say, well, the United States wishes you well. We're interested in talking about relations between the independent Mexico and the United States. We'd like to talk about trade and things like that. And then they said, oh, by the way, we have a slight problem with boundaries. You know about the Louisiana Purchase, Shaler was supposed to say. And on the basis of that, we have a claim to Texas and Florida. But what these instructions say, or what they tell Shaler to say, is if a New Mexican government is prepared to accept the fact that Florida, east and west, will become part of the United States. The United States says, we don't want Texas. We're not interested in Texas. Texas can stay part of Mexico. We don't want, you know, we don't care about a boundary on the Rio Grande. It contemplates a boundary considerably further to the east of the Rio Grande at that period. And eventually, this is how it comes out in the transcript of the Treaty of 1819, when in fact the United States gets undisputed control over all Floridas. In return, they give Texas to Mexico. That's to give a little further ahead of the story. What actually happened with Shaler is that he never got to Veracruz or to Mexico City. The problem was the Spanish would not give him a passport to go from Havana to Veracruz. In other words, he could not enter the country legally. So he stayed on Cuba for about a year. The Spanish watched him. Then they thought he was a bit of a suspicious character. Therefore, they rounded up and plopped him in a boat and sent him back to New Orleans. And it was in New Orleans that Shaler then meets Gutierrez, who's this Mexican rebel who has come to the United States seeking aid from Americans against the Spanish government of Mexico. And so Shaler then decides that he will join with Gutierrez on his return back to Mexico, and that he's going back through Louisiana. The way you do it, you go to Natchitoches, which is the furthermost military post inside what is the state of Louisiana at that point, and then you cross over into Texas or Mexican territory over the boundary with Louisiana at that point. So in other words, Shaler goes with this agent, trying to get into Mexico through the back door, because he can't get through the front door of Vera Cruz. And as I said, Shaler's instructions make no mentions of subversion, filibusters, or anything like that. And what his diaries and his letters make very clear, and other sources, that although he knew a great deal about what Gutierrez and Urquiza were trying to do, he knew they were organizing an invasion of Texas. But he said two things. He said, I can't stop this. I'm only one man. How do I stop a band of thugs who are armed to the teeth, etc., etc.? I don't have the authority to do that. Law enforcement's not my job. I'm just telling you what's happening. And he also said he didn't think this was a very good idea. He was a bit suspicious of these characters, and he didn't think this was the best way for Americans to preserve their interests on that particular boundary line. So, in fact, he does not approve, but he writes back and says, look, it's happening anyway. And if it does happen, and if they do set up a government, I might follow after them and carry out my mission that way. And everything that Shaler did after that point is consistent with that until we get to the spring of 1813, when he does intervene in the filibuster and he tries to overthrow, he does overthrow Gutierrez and replace him with another Spanish leader, Toledo, as I mentioned. Now, Shaler did this not because Washington told him to do this. They haven't written anything about this. Shaler did this on his own initiative because it was his response to what happened after the Mexican rebels took control of San Antonio in the spring of 1813. This was a nasty business, and after the rebels had captured San Antonio, they massacred all the Spanish officers. They took them outside the town, cut their throats, and sort of let their bodies to rot. In the desert. And this outraged Shaler. His correspondence, you can see, he talks about the black act of tyranny and murder and things like this. If this is the future of Mexico, we want no part of it. And at that point, he says, we need to put a decent leader in charge of the Mexican rebels. So Shaler does this not because he thinks the United States is trying to get Texas or at this point. He simply says, he's asking the question, what sort of neighbor might an independent Mexico be with the United States? Do we want a barbarous, murderous despotism taking over Texas? Or do we want something more enlightened, something more Republican? That's Shaler's concern there. And that's why he intervened in the filibuster at that point in time. Anyway, the rebels take San Antonio. They declare Texas to be independent. The news of this gets back to Washington about June 1813. What does Madison do? Well, he did exactly the same as what he did with Matthews in 1812. Monroe wrote back and says, you're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to be part of this rebellion. This rebellion is awful. You are to get your tail out of Mexico as quickly as possible and have nothing further to do with these people. The repudiation of the filibuster is quite unequivocal. Now, at this time, there's no problem of unfortunate timing, as there was with East Florida in the spring of 1812. You could argue that Madison had wanted that filibuster to go on and sort of take Texan and Mexican territory away from Spain. All he had to do was say, carry on with your mission. But he didn't say that. He wrote a letter saying, get out of there, because what you're doing is wrong. So, bringing this finally to conclusion, what does these three episodes tell us about Madison and his dealings with the Spanish war agents? What do they tell us about him as a president. Now, I mentioned the agent historian saying, well, there's a pattern of covert operations here. And underneath each of these episodes, there's a common modus operandi of sending an agent in to contact rebels, to work with the rebels, and then get these territories next to the United States. But if you look at the details of these three episodes, that's not what happens at all. They're all rather different episodes. And in each case, the Americans, or Madison, has a different policy for these regions, according to how he assesses what the American interest is in this region at that particular point in time. But at no point, and in no case of any of these three episodes, is fomenting rebellion and subverting governments part of Madison's plan. And in fact, two of the agents do go off the rails and engage in these sorts of activities. Madison repudiates their activities. I don't think that's really, if we think the CIA's business is organising covert operations, these aren't terribly good historical precedents for that sort of thing. And finally, and you've been very patient, and I thank you for that, what does this tell us about Madison as a president? Was he the weak, indecisive, fumbling president that we know from reading about the histories of the War of 1812? The Madison that I said we'll probably be hearing a fair bit about in the next two or three years. Now, these episodes, I think, suggest that what we regard as the conventional wisdom about Madison as a president might be wrong. Whatever we might think of Madison's policies towards Spain, they don't actually suggest that he was weak or indecisive. What they show instead is that he actually worked quite hard at trying to predict the future course of events, and what the future course of those events would be on what he regarded as essential American interests on the frontiers of the United States at that time, along the Gulf Coast and in the Caribbean. And they also show that Madison did not hesitate to repudiate these agents when the agents did something that he thought was wrong and did not serve American interests. In other words, they show us a Madison that's more decisive, more thoughtful, and more forceful than reading the histories of the War of 1812 would lead us to suggest. They might even suggest that the conventional picture we have of Madison as a wartime president between 1812 and 1815 is also somewhat wrong. But I'm not going to start on that today. I'll stop there. And thank you for your patience.